Brian Lynch, Rod Alley, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this invitation to be here this morning. We're here to consider New Zealand's foreign policy and its priorities over the next 5 years. And I have to begin by saying a week is a long time in politics. Now, that's true, then 5 years is an extraordinarily long time to be discerning and presaging what may happen with respect to our foreign policy engagement. But it's worth making some observations at the outset about New Zealand foreign policy in a political context. The first is that historically, the broad direction of foreign policy has received bipartisan support in New Zealand. And in our recent past, almost all foreign affairs legislation presented to Parliament has received near unanimous support. Even with the advent of MMP and a multi-party Parliament, there has been a continuation of this general consensus. The second observation is that the people of New Zealand have also generally supported the main thrust of foreign policy under successive governments. Indeed, it would be fair to say that inherent New Zealand values and unique New Zealand perspectives have been reflected in the formulation and conduct of our foreign policy. And over the years, New Zealanders have taken pride in the way that we have been active in world affairs in a way that belies our geographical location and relatively small size. Institute Director Brian Lynch waited all of 2 days before inviting me to the seminar. And I have to tell you that we were glad to accept, but not before we got a grasp of what was intended to happen at our time on the watch. Not before APEC, or the Commonwealth Foreign Affairs meeting in Malta, or our visit to the UK for a bilateral visit and EU presidency consultations, and to KL, to something that looks to be dynamic, and that is the inaugural East Asia Summit. And a visit to Fiji would have just taken place, the first in a series of visits to the Pacific Island nations, which is an explicit priority in my travel program for the first half of 2006. After all, this is the neighbourhood in which we live, and we need to understand how important it is in the way the world might see us now and in the future. So priorities over the next few years, or the next 5 years? Well, to begin with, the observation that foreign policy is often about responding to international developments that are unforeseen, certainly in their specifics, and over which we have little control. The terrorist attacks of 11 September 2001, the Asian tsunami are examples of major events that are both required to be confronted by us in a multifaceted way and a change in an environment in which we operate. This speech is not about gazing into a crystal ball. History is full of examples of predictions of future developments in world affairs that turned out to be wide of the mark. Neville Chamberlain's Peace in Our Time comes immediately to mind to all of us. But his successor as Prime Minister of Great Britain and my namesake could also get it wrong. Only a few years before the Peace in Our Time forecast, Winston Churchill had said, and I quote him, that no conceivable quarrel could arise between us and Japan. End of quotes. But with reasonable confidence, we can highlight in 2006 a number of overarching trends that are likely to continue. And these include the interlinked phenomena that are known as globalization, and related to this, the dynamism of Asia-Pacific relations and in the region itself, the persistence of international security and development challenges, and uncertain progress towards making multilateral institutions more effective. Globalization is one of those buzzwords that's become so widely used, it's in danger of losing its usefulness. However, we have yet to come up with a better word, so I'll use it. Beyond doubt, the rapid development of information and communications technology and the global expansion of economic activity and linkages has had both positive and negative effects. For New Zealand, globalization has had a demonstrable effect on our economy, our standard of living, and the makeup of our society. There's also the well-documented downside to globalization. And in our neighbourhood, as our Pacific friends will tell us, Pacific Island countries have had to contend with social pressures resulting from much more contact with the outside world and are challenged by issues of scale and distance. These are real constraints in an interlinked and increasingly competitive world. The East Asian region has benefited from globalisation and experienced a sustained period of rapid economic expansion with only occasional setbacks. But of course, those societies are unique. They've had the capacity to confront huge challenges that I'm sure the Western world could not have dealt with in the way they have. How many Western countries, for example, could have seen a depreciation of their currency by 60 to 80% and possibly survived to make a comeback within a matter of years? Back in 97, when the Thai baht fell out of bed, some of us foresaw that the Asian economies would come right, and some were enormously pessimistic. And I suppose in time you get to see who understands how important culture is in the economy and in politics. But we're talking about, as I said, real constraints in an interlinked and increasingly competitive region. And the dynamism of Asia is evident not just in economic terms. We've witnessed the emergence of a region that is increasingly confident and outward-looking. The stakes for New Zealand, as it sought to deepen its political and economic engagement with Asia, have been extraordinarily high. While we may be geographically distant from the centres of the world's worst conflict and human suffering, New Zealand has little choice but to play its part in responding to pressing security and developing challenges. In other parts of the world, it's significant that these things are happening and we have to respond in any way and manner that we can. Over time, the nature of these challenges has changed dramatically. It was not too long ago, for example, that we witnessed the dramatic consequences, again both positive and negative, of the end of the phase of superpower rivalry known as the Cold War. Today we confront the reality that terrorism and the threat posed by the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction require considered international responses. We have seen, and are likely to continue to see, proliferation of what has been described as problems without passports. Accordingly, the need for effective multilateral institutions is as great as ever. We all remember that the United Nations was founded in 1945, and the world's changed considerably since then. Changes in the way the UN system operates have not always kept pace. The simple fact is that we see today arrangements inherited from the past that struggle to deal with an increasing range of global challenges, such as pressure on natural resources and the environment, infectious diseases, including possible pandemics, and natural disasters, to mention only a few. If the international community fails to make the multilateral system work more effectively, the result will be inadequate responses to serious security and development challenges that threaten New Zealand's interests directly and indirectly. In this environment, New Zealand's foreign policy machinery needs to monitor developments, discern trends, identify threats and opportunities, and devise appropriate policy responses, including air conditioning in a place like this. Well, it is hot here. The response to the economic challenges related to globalisation will be described by my colleague Phil Goff in his address tomorrow morning. But one observation for today: our success in taking advantage of the benefits of globalisation and minimising the negative impact will continue to be a major determining factor in whether or not New Zealand's economic performance is lifted onto a higher level. And having a well-performing domestic economy will mean that we can generate the resources we need to sustain effective foreign policy initiatives and interventions to protect and advance the interests of New Zealanders and to make a worthwhile contribution to making the rest of the world a little bit more secure. Over the next 5 years, our foreign policy engagement will continue to take place in three areas: our bilateral relationships, our regional diplomacy, and in the multilateral arena. It would be unwise to prioritise one area over the others. On many issues, satisfactory outcomes will depend on properly coordinated engagement in all three areas. To give just one example, it's extremely important for New Zealand and the rest of the world that the current situation of reasonable, stable relations between the major powers should continue. This, however, can't be taken for granted and will require careful management by the major powers themselves. Achievement of stable major power relations will also be assisted by other members of the international community, managing in a responsible and constructive manner their bilateral relations with the major powers, promoting regional cooperation to deal with issues of common concern, and undertaking repair work on the post-World War II system of collective security enshrined in the Charter of the UN. Over the next 5 years, it will be vitally important that we work to enhance our relationships with the countries that impact to the greatest extent on New Zealand's direct interests, our regional environment, and the global order. Our key relationships include those with Australia, the United States, Pacific Island countries, Japan, China and Europe, other APEC members and those involved in the East Asia Summit. New Zealand's relationship, as you know, with Australia is unique and will remain a cornerstone of our foreign policy. There will be a further consideration of common interests and the scope of even closer collaboration between us when Alexander Downer visits Wellington later this week. Notwithstanding the disparity in size and influence in world affairs, there is potential for deriving greater mutual benefit from our relationship with the United States. This will happen from recognition of interests we have in common and the willingness to support each other on key issues where we can. Just as I say this by way of an observation, we have the ability to influence in a positive way the views and opinions of one quarter of the globe out here in the Pacific, all the way beyond Tahiti to Easter Island. Our connection with the Pacific in dealing with the United States is important, and I suspect it may be something that they have for so long overlooked, but in which we have placed so much effort and time that we should remind them of what we've done and why we're doing it, so that they might better understand how 4.2 million people do matter in this world. But I'll come back to our conversation I had at APEC with US Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill. As a former US ambassador in Seoul, now responsible for East Asian and Pacific affairs, Chris Hill knows very well that New Zealand's position on North Korea, our contributions to the campaign against international terrorism, and our commitment to addressing security issues in the Pacific region all serve to support the attainment of US objectives. New Zealand has an important stake in progress being made in addressing the challenges facing Pacific Island countries, as I said. Our relationship in the Pacific are a special priority for the government and for me personally. This is where we live, for some of us, for 1,000 years. As mentioned earlier, this has been reflected in my planned program of overseas travel this year, which includes visits to half of the 16 members of the Pacific Islands Forum by mid-year. Japan plays an increasingly important role in world affairs, and particularly in the East Asian and Asia-Pacific region. Our approaches on priority national and regional issues are remarkably similar, and we are committed to this long-standing and close relationship. With China, there's been a remarkable evolution in the relationship in recent years, truly remarkable. We will continue to make every effort to expand what is increasingly becoming a broad-based relationship and to explore new areas of cooperation. Our interests in Europe are also expanding and diversifying. We're responding by strengthening our relations with the European Union and its institutions and maintaining and taking forward relationships with key bilateral partners in Europe. As resources permit, we'll put effort into strengthening our bilateral relations with other countries as well. For example, in Latin America, where we are implementing a long-term strategy to strengthen our relations, the Middle East, our new embassy in Cairo will open soon, and in Africa. And of course, our Commonwealth connections will always be valuable. Every relationship that has the potential to be positive is important to New Zealand. Sustained bilateral engagement will continue to be required both to maximise benefits to New Zealand and to reduce the risks. On the issue of regional diplomacy, in the years ahead we will continue to use our participation in regional arrangements in the Asia-Pacific region as a force multiplier in our diplomacy. New Zealand's participation in the East Asia Summit marks a new and developing stage in our relations with East Asia, and the fact that it's going to be annualised is important. The invitation to be part of the East Asia Summit was in recognition of New Zealand's commitment over time to developing productive bilateral relations with countries in East Asia and with ASEAN as an entity, and contributing to maximising the potential of groupings such as ASEAN and its regional forum. The largest regional circle with which we are engaged, APEC, is and will remain strategically important to New Zealand, as it encompasses a broader rate of membership than the East Asia Summit, and of course it includes the United States. This underpins continued US engagement with the region, something on which we place great importance. As is the case in East Asia, we are seeing much greater interest in expanding regional cooperation in the Pacific. During its year as chair of the Pacific Island Forum, New Zealand played an important role in initiating what became the Pacific Plan. The Auckland Declaration of 2004 recorded the commitment of forum members to develop new avenues to strengthen and deepen regional cooperation. And this will shape the work of the forum in the next decade and beyond. Now, there was reference earlier to the multilateral system being under stress. In this, the member states of the United Nations and the organisation itself all have some responsibility. It could be argued that neither the member states nor the UN itself is really to blame, but that the complexity and magnitude of issues confronting it are such that no single organisation can deal with them. New Zealand takes a very pragmatic approach. We are not committed to multilateralism for the sake of it, but to multilateralism that works. We also see a role for effective regionalism, and not every issue needs to wash up at the door of the United Nations. But we believe that the world would be sustainably worse off without the UN. The UN is in need of reform so it can adapt to the changed environment in which it operates. New Zealand is committed to playing a constructive part of this reform. New Zealand does not believe that more institutions are what is required. There is no shortage of institutions, but there is a shortage of institutions working efficiently and effectively. And the member states of these institutions have to take responsibility for this. There are some issues that, quite simply, can only be addressed properly if the international community as a whole is involved. These include, for example, climate change, threats to biosafety, and dealing with pollutants. And in the area of international peace and security, we are of the firm belief that without wide acceptance of the central importance of collective security based on the United Nations, the world would be an even more dangerous place than it is today. As well as pursuing foreign policy objectives through bilateral, regional and multilateral engagement, New Zealand will also continue to be involved in interventions to address specific security and development challenges. We recognise that international security is threatened by the existence within states of injustice, poverty and conflict, and the lack of representative government, freedom and the protection of human rights. This awareness has informed the New Zealand response to international terrorism. We have been prepared to commit our military forces to UN-mandated combat operations against terrorists in Afghanistan. And we've made other substantial contributions to enhancing security in that country through the deployment of a provincial reconstruction team and providing training assistance to the Afghan security forces. But New Zealand has also contributed humanitarian and development assistance and supported democratic elections and improving capacity to uphold human rights standards. A similar comprehensive and multidimensional approach was seen in our involvement with other partners in Bougainville, in East Timor, and more recently in the Solomon Islands. It's a priority for the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade to strengthen professional expertise in the areas of conflict prevention and resolution. As well as MFAT and NZAID, other government agencies, including police and border control agencies, are increasing their capacity to provide assistance to other countries. And they are developing mechanisms to coordinate their efforts with the work of agencies in other countries, international organisations and individuals and NGOs with particular expertise and resources, both in New Zealand and in the countries where foreign assistance is required. There is increasing awareness of the interconnectedness between poverty, governance and security. Common sense tells you that these are connected, that one strongly influences the other. In the first years of the 21st century, there's greater awareness of these connections as we have faced up to the plague that is international terrorism and the extent of poverty and rapid human suffering that is obviously tied to the poor performance of under-resourced or corrupt or incompetent governments. Today, over 1 billion people live on less than $1 a day in a world that has the ability to reduce poverty dramatically. It's also, in economic terms, a huge opportunity cost on societies and on the global community through foregone productivity and foregone creativity. The development challenge has never been higher on the international agenda. For the first time in history, the international community has agreed on specific goals, the Millennium Development Goals and timelines to address key poverty indicators. To make poverty history is a campaign that has gained a high profile and lay behind the willingness of G8 countries last year to agree to substantial debt relief. New Zealand is part of the Asia-Pacific region. We and the Pacific Island countries and much of near Asia occupy the same economic, social and security space. The flows of goods and services, and the Pacific is New Zealand's seventh most important export market after all, the flow of goods and services, people, funds, investment and ODA, and the quality of economic growth and social development in our region are matters of common interest. That means that the deeply concerning poverty indicators in parts of the Pacific are our problem too. It's in our interest and theirs to see that our Pacific neighbours are well educated, healthy, able to earn a living and can embrace the values underpinning a well-governed democratic society. New Zealand's response to the development challenge, both at the global level and in our own region, has included the establishment of a dedicated professional aid agency called NZA. And we have steadily increased ODA, which is up a record $60 million, or 23%, in the current budget, with two more years of upward trending funding also committed. Now, many of you will say it's not enough. In fact, we all would. But it's better than it was, much better. It's a priority for an NZA to ensure that it's effective in its development programs, through sound policy and strategic development, and through working in partnership with developing countries and other donors to achieve better development outcomes. It's essential that every effort be made, both to ensure the effectiveness of the delivery of New Zealand aid and to increase the overall amount. To conclude, there was mention earlier of the perils of trying to forecast future developments in world affairs. But it's possible to say with complete certainty that over the next 5 years and beyond, it will remain vitally important for the future security and prosperity of New Zealanders that our foreign policy be finely tuned to changing circumstances. It will be equally important that we identify clearly our priorities and pursue our foreign policy objectives with determination. And more importantly, governments come and go. So do ministers of foreign affairs and heads of department. But people remain in their localities and their relationships are the most important thing. And so when you think about foreign policy in the big picture, we should think beyond our narrow political perspective and think about how things will be in 20 years and 30 years from now because of the things that we did now whilst we were temporarily empowered. Thank you.